Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have been anxious to speak with our first guest for some time, and not for want of trying on his part. We have had difficulty making this work, but we are thrilled at last to have Roger Kimball, the editor and publisher of two terrific outfits, the New Criterion, and the president, I should say, and publisher of Encounter Books. These are really iconic institutions in American intellectual thought, and we're so grateful to Roger for his leadership of both. He is a regular columnist for American Greatness, the Epoch Times, the U.S. edition of The Spectator, an author of important works like The Rape of the Masters, How Political Correctness Sabotages Art and Lives of the Mind, The Use and Abuse of Intelligence, from Hegel to Wodehouse. He is an intellect, public intellect of the first order, and a very welcome guest here. Roger, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Frank, your frankness does you credit, as Lady Bracknell might say. Thank you for that very generous introduction. And perhaps I should bring out a new edition of The Rape of the Masters, which of course is about how political correctness has sabotaged the teaching and study of art. Maybe I should bring out a new edition called The Race of the Masters, since everything is about race these days.
It is indeed. It is indeed. You forgive my Freudian slip there. Roger Kimball, there's a lot to talk about. I'm particularly appreciative of your sort of 30,000-foot perspective on the state of our nation, and more generally the world. But I thought before we get into sort of your perspectives on what is happening here, I might ask you to take us across that northern border into Canada. And you've written recently about what Prime Minister Trudeau is up to. In the past 24 hours, this has metastasized considerably with what it seems to be is the declaration of martial law in that country.
Yes. Yes.
Tell us what it portends.
Just moments before joining you, I finished another column, which will be out in an hour or so, probably in the Spectator world, the American edition of the London Spectator. And I compared well, first of all, let's just there may be one or two of your listeners who's not fully on board with what's just happened in Canada, but little Justin Trudeau is the first person to have invoked the Emergencies Act. This is a 1980s piece of legislation drafted to deal with national emergencies, invasion from foreign powers, the really bad stuff. So nobody's done this before, but this gives him the, as you say, basically he's declared martial law. He's freezing bank accounts of people he doesn't like. They are his ghastly deputy prime minister, Chrystia Freeland, I'm quoting here. She says, Canada's anti-money laundering and terrorist finance rules are being expanded so that they cover crowdfunding platforms and payment services and cryptocurrencies and the like. So they're really trying to shut down everything. And what is the tort? Well, these truckers have embarrassed poor little Justin. They've embarrassed him. They've made him look like a fool, and that cannot stand. So I took a page from Roman history from Livy. You know, there in the course of early Roman history, there the plebs seceded five times. They said, no, we're not going to do this anymore. And they took to the hills, and Rome was left without people to staff the army or do all of the work in the city. And it was kind of a general strike avant la lettre. And the most serious and successful of these secessions of the plebs was in 449 BC, when protesting there's a ruling. It was a ruling committee called the Decemvirs, the 10 men, this sort of an administrative state before its time. They were trying to neuter the tribunates of the common people and take away their rights. And they said, forget it. And they won. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, Canadians have a reputation of being very polite, very pacific, not acting out or acting up. But I'm wondering, you know, watching the Freedom Convoy, watching these peaceful protesters go about their business. And, you know, the coronavirus vaccine mandates, that was the ostensible reason for these protests, but it obviously was not the real reason or the deep reason, because 90% of the truckers were vaccinated. It was really about the intrusive nature of the coercive power of the state in an unaccountable way. I mean, what Justin Trudeau has just done is a page from the tyrannies of the 20th century. You know, all of these juntas all over the place where the colonels come in and declare martial law and freeze bank accounts and arrest and indict and imprison people. That's what they're doing. And I hope it won't stand. And I hope that Americans south of the 49th parallel, who were seem to be inspired by this rousing display of independence, I hope that they'll take a page from the Canadians and do likewise here.
That's really why I wanted to start with your perspective on Canada, Roger, is we are facing a similar sort of tyranny, as you've documented in your various columns of late, from the government of the United States. And it has not yet come to martial law, thank God, but the vaccine mandates and the mask mandates and the lockdowns and the vaccine passports to enforce all of the above have begun our trajectory, it would seem, towards the kind of end state that Justin Trudeau has now imposed on Canada, if we're not very careful, as you say. And I would like you to sort of walk us through your assessment of both how far we've come down that road and whether there's yet a point at which we can put a brake on this. There does seem to be some growing reluctance on the part of certain Democratic governors, notably, to proceed under the circumstances. But where are we headed, do you think, and how far gone are we?
Well, I mean, the fact that, you know, I work in New York, and so the fact that you have to present a vaccine passport and identification to go into a restaurant. It's, you know, you feel like you're in Berlin in 1938. Papiere, Anka, yeah. And, you know, and I'm told that the Metropolitan Opera and Carnegie Hall and the restaurants run by Danny Myers now are requiring to be counted as fully vaccinated. You have to show that you've also had a booster shot. Now, anyone who's actually had COVID and gets a booster shot gets very sick. You know, it's contraindicated. You shouldn't do it, in my opinion. So I find this. It's, you know, if I were a budding totalitarian, I would be looking very carefully at the way the American people behaved in response to this latest respiratory virus sent to us from China with the ministrations of Anthony Fauci and the American taxpayers' dollars, because the two alarming things were, one, the willingness of you know, proto totalitarians like Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan and other governors, Andrew Cuomo and so on, to use the coercive power of the state to force people to do things. It was extraordinary. But maybe even more disturbing was the sheep-like behavior of the people. They just said, okay, whatever you say, we have to wear a mask, even though these masks don't do anything. They're like the yellow stars that that the Jews had to wear in Germany. They're badges of compliance. They're actually a little different from those yellow stars because they have two significations. One is they're badges of compliance. They're saying, yes, I am a sheep. But they're also little virtue signaling devices because people have said, oh, well, you have to wear a mask because that shows that you care about people. When, of course, the masks do nothing. But still, there are people who just love to be able to parade their virtue. And the mask, wearing a mask is one way of doing that. Now, you mentioned that there seems to be a growing reluctance among some governors and other state officials to keep these mandates in place. I think that's true. I think it's the reason is partly because of the data. I mean, you know, it's clear that this latest variant, the Omicron variant, is rapidly disappearing. But also, it's the prospect of the 2022 midterm elections, where the Democrats are, you know, slated to lose historic number of seats. And these mandates are very unpopular, except in places like Ann Arbor or Manhattan or, you know, parts of California and so on. But in most of the country, they're deeply, deeply, deeply unpopular. And I think that the newfound willingness to relax some of these mandates is partly an expression of self-preservation on the part of the politicians.
Even where they're not unpopular, I think it's pretty clear that they're having a highly deleterious effect on the economy, and in varied degrees, the children and the society more generally.
Well, economy, and I mean, you know, it's heartbreaking to watch these young kids, you know, walking around wearing masks in school, and so I mean, it's crippling. I mean, it's a form of child abuse. They don't get to, you know, interact with their peers. It's someday there's going to be a lot of lawsuits, I bet, because the children have lost a couple of years of schooling, but even more important, they've lost this critical time in their development, their psychological development. They're, you know, in school, they can't see one another's faces. It's like some bizarre dystopian novel, except that it's real life. And the teachers are it's appalling, just appalling.
So much of that is appalling, I'm afraid. And I wanted to come to a piece that you wrote recently for American Greatness entitled, Do You Trust the U.S. Government? And for reasons that you've just gone over, I think there's reason not to. But you were specifically focused, as I recall, on an interaction between the State Department spokesman and a member of the press corps, I believe from the Associated Press, about Ukraine. And I'd really like your thoughts on Ukraine. I just had a conversation elsewhere with a friend, I believe of both of ours, Trevor Loudon, about Ukraine.
Ned Price, you know, State Department spokesman and former CIA operative who, you know, at this, he had this press conference after John Kirby, a Pentagon spokesman, was talking about how the Russians were, you know, creating this propaganda film, you know, to create a sort of false flag so that to justify an invasion of Ukraine. And so this AP reporter said, well, what's your evidence for this? And the guy said, well, I just told you. And the AP reporter says, well, no, you didn't give me any evidence. You made a statement. You made an allegation. What is your evidence for that? It just went on and on like that. It was hilarious. But I don't trust him.
And this is another basis upon which our trust in the United States government is seemingly unwarranted. Frayed and fraying, indeed. Roger Kimball, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today and for bearing with us on so many challenges, technical and otherwise. We look forward to visiting with you at greater length very soon. In the meantime, keep up the terrific work you're doing. Godspeed. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton about much, much of the rest of the planet's challenges right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure always to say we are joined by Bill Walton. He is one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, a man who brings an enormous breadth of talent, notably from his time as a master of the universe on Wall Street, but also as a leader of the conservative movement here in the nation's capital in more recent times, notably as the past president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm very proud to be a member. He is the host of a terrific television podcast program, The Bill Walton Show, which I commend to all of you, and a great friend as well. I'm always glad to have him with us. Bill, thanks so much for joining us again.
Well, nice to be with you, Frank, as always.
Well, especially to have your perspective on a very, very important development, it seems to me. I did my commentary on it this morning. The Durham special prosecution investigation has now taken what seems to be, at long last, a turn many of us have prayed for, in the belief that if there is no rule of law in this country, there won't be much of a country left in fairly short order. Bill, talk to us a little bit about what developed on Friday in terms of that investigation and its implications as you see them.
Well, by way of background, you know, we've listened about the Russia collusion scenario forever, it seems. And it turns out this story may have been one of the dirtiest tricks in U.S. political history. In fact, there's nothing behind that story. And on Friday, Special Counsel John Dunnan, who's the man who's been working to unravel the conclusion story, filed against Michael Sussman, who was a lawyer who represented the Clinton campaign, and he was with the firm Perkins Coie, which works with the left on almost all these issues. And specific accusation, he was lying to the FBI when he denied that there were any work on his behalf or the campaign's behalf, Hillary Clinton, to spy on Donald Trump. And in fact, they did. And the indictment calls out a man named Rodney Joffrey, who was with Newstar Inc., who provided him with inside internet data traffic at the Trump apartment on the west side, the all Trump Tower. And most chillingly, internet data inside the in the White House. And this began before the election, as early as midsummer 2016. And what the indictment doesn't tell us is, you know, when did this end? But they were monitoring all the internet traffic, and you know, we've got a, you know, Joffe denies it, but it's I guess they've pretty much got him red-handed. And they were, what they were doing was they're trying to build a case that there was a connection between Trump and this Russian mobile phone operator, and that was not the case. And let me see if I can find the exact quote here. It's quite good. Mr. Joffe's goal was to create an inference and narrative about Mr. Trump that would please certain VIPs, referring to the lawyers at Perkins Coie and the Clinton campaign. And the, you know, the questions here. How long did this go on? Who had access to what was found? Who approved it in the White House? And who specifically were the people in the FBI and in the White House that knew about it? Because somebody certainly did. And it certainly begs the question, was Mrs. Clinton and the senior people in her campaign personally aware of what was going on? And I think the question answers itself. But, you know, this takes it well beyond the Steele dossier, and you know, which was about, I can't remember the full story, some Russian immigre working in Washington, you know, working with Trump and Putin. It was all just a complete work of fiction. This is not fiction. They're actually monitoring internet traffic, and we need to get a lot deeper into this one to find out who else was involved, who was doing it, who approved it, and how long it lasted.
So just so I'm clear, Bill, is the suggestion that somebody in the Trump White House was letting them have access to this information, or is it somebody in the Obama White House who facilitated what took place on their watch and somehow enabled that access to continue after they left? I'm a little unclear.
It began well, Obama was in the White House, and it began with the Obama team and continued on into January, February after Trump was inaugurated. And after that, it's not clear to me how much longer it did last. And, you know, when you know, the White House is one of the few agencies where there's almost a complete transition of personnel when the administration changes. So, you know, the question is, was there somebody left in the IT department who was still funneling this information while Trump was president? We don't know yet, but it's certainly possible.
Watch this space, folks, is all I can say. This is breaking news of tremendous import because, Bill, as you certainly appreciate, it's not just that this was about partisan political machinations and criminal activity, it would certainly seem. But if this were going on, it's especially with the leakiness of Hillary Clinton's operations.
Remember her server?
Yeah. There's almost certainty that you had hostile powers also having access to some of the most sensitive traffic in the world.
That's the elephant in the room. I mean, it's clear that if somebody like this could penetrate the White House and do what they did with Trump Tower and the other Trump apartment, they can do this with anyone. And it's probably my guess and your guess is it's still going on and probably is still monitoring White House traffic. And certainly my guess is with Biden coming in last year, they've resumed operations.
Or continued operations, as the case may be. Great stuff, Bill, huge import, obviously, on all of these levels. And thank you for covering it for us. And we'll definitely be taking stock with you in the days to come about it and others. I wanted to go through, speaking of the Biden administration, some of the personnel decisions, Bill, that are now awaiting action by the United States Senate in a couple of key posts. Individuals who seem to have something in common. Well, they're all female for one thing, but they all seem to be pretty hard left as well. And again, that may not be surprising given the character of this administration and its policy approach. But for some of these jobs that, for example, Sarah Raskin is being proposed to fill, namely, in her case, the number two position on the Federal Reserve. It's very, very troubling that this sort of ideological agenda seems to be the principal qualification for the job, or at least the principal qualification justification for this particular nomination. Tell us about Sarah, for starters.
Well, Sarah is an extremely dangerous candidate for the number two job in the Federal Reserve, overseeing financial institution bank regulation. She's very smart. She knows the financial services industry. She was on the board of the Federal Reserve and also Deputy Treasury Secretary. She's also one of the most radical climate people you can find, and believes that Federal Reserve policy should be to shut down the fossil fuel industry, you know, basically by chalking off capital to oil and gas firms and related. She's married to Jamie Raskin, who's on the January 6th commission, and we know what that kangaroo court is doing.
Senior leftist member of Congress, yeah.
Yeah, senior leftist member. They're quite a power couple, Frank. Quite a power couple. Anyway, so in addition to her really bad ideas when it comes to climate and her sophistication, she's a very sophisticated financial operator. And while she was on the board, I believe it was on, while she was deputy secretary, what year was it? 2018, she became, or 2017, she joined the board of directors of a company called Reserve Trust. What Reserve Trust does is it engage in payment processing related to business-to-business transactions. And it's extremely valuable to be a chartered company to obtain a Federal Reserve master account, which gives a company direct access to Federal Reserve clearing, payment, and settlement services. Well, while she was on the board, she made a call to the Fed to ask that they approve this company's status, and they did so. And it's really, while it's not illegal per se, it certainly smells to high heaven. And when she joined the board, she received almost 200,000 shares of the stock. She sold the shares in 2020 for $1.4 million. Pretty good work, pretty good pay for 3 years on a board. Of course, she was worth every penny because this company's got this special status accorded to them by the Fed. And this is happening, Frank, all along the time when you get Elizabeth Warren condemning Randall Quarles for terrible conflict of interest, because what he did is he returned to work for a private equity company that he founded. So this is part of the terrible revolving door that Elizabeth Warren is always complaining about. Well, she ought to look very closely at her own nominee, Sarah Raskin.
It'll be very interesting to see if she does, won't it?
I'll hold my breath, Frank.
Speaking of the Federal Reserve, Bill Walton, let me talk to you about another nominee of Joe Biden, Lisa Cook, Dr. Lisa Cook, I believe it is. Tell us about her and her qualifications for this position, and apparently her own pretty strongly held hard left agenda.
Well, on paper, she's got quite a pedigree. I don't have her resume in front of me, but she's got a PhD in finance economics from a big university, and she has had some pretty important jobs. The issue, though, is you see this all the time in Washington, is people have nice resumes and they move from position to position, but they never actually demonstrate they know anything. And if you look at everything she's written as an academic and otherwise, it's all about critical race theory and social justice and, you know, righting the wrongs that that America is all about. And so we've got another, you know, she's black, she's female, so we've got another race warrior who Biden wants to put on the board of the Federal Reserve. And that's sort of, in my mind, you know, that's part of the issue. The other part of the issue, she doesn't seem to know anything about monetary economics. So we're adding somebody else into the mix when we've got a Federal Reserve, which is printing money like mad, and I think is likely to have a very, very tough next couple of years as we try to unwind all this monetary madness that's been going on. And we're adding yet another unqualified person to the mix.
Well, again, if this were the only example of this sort of
it goes on
racist
and on
preoccupation.
Well, and then we've got our head injected of the FTC.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to turn to her next, Bill, but this is just fitting increasingly, isn't it, a pattern of people who are determined to use whatever instruments they have at their disposal to advance
we have
arguably
Biden
the most radical and, I would say, communist agenda in our history.
Well, whatever you want to call it, Marxist, nihilist, totalitarian, I can think of 53 labels for these people. But the one thing they all have in common is they don't know anything about the private sector. They don't know anything about wealth creation. They don't understand anything about the markets that created the prosperity that's brought billions of people out of poverty worldwide. These people are wholly ignorant of that. And they weigh in on things that they know very little about, with a political agenda, and worse, they're in a position to make policy to further damage the economy. And the head of the FTC is now blaming inflation on price fixing among big companies. Well, I don't think that Microsoft is price fixing with Apple, and I don't think that's the way the modern economy works anymore. What does work in creating inflation is massive federal spending in the trillions, massive federal deficits in the 3 or 4 trillion range, you know, debt that's 30 trillion, Federal Reserve flooding the market with money, buying back the treasury debt, and in fact, paying for these deficits with inflation. So there's a culprit, and it lies right in front of us in the middle of the road. And instead, you've got the head of the FTC blaming these mysterious price fixers somewhere, somehow, that it's all their fault.
Bill Walton, I think that the key point here is that we're in a world of hurt at the moment on a lot of different fronts. We're going to be talking about Ukraine in a moment and what may flow from Russia's ambitions to, crush that part of the free world.
Well, I put out a piece today, Frank. We had Mike Waller and Peter Pry on, and I'll just real quickly, you know, Mike points out, or Peter points out, that we have very little understanding of what Russia and China are doing with each other. They formed an alliance. The Pentagon itself is war-gamed, defending Taiwan in case of a Chinese invasion 18 different times. And 18 different times, China won the war game. So we're playing with fire here with people in administration, and the foreign policy establishment or elites under Biden are very little different from the economic elites that he's trying to put in place. We have a lot to worry about.
Similar agendas, global warming being the greatest threat we face, and domestic terrorists that look a lot like Trump voters being the greatest national security and homeland security challenge. Bill Walton, I congratulate you on the Waller-Pry tag team, and look forward to seeing it myself, and encourage all of our listeners to watch it and all of the Bill Walton show. Thank you for your time today on our program, Securing America being our mutual interest, and for all that you do for that purpose and cause. And next up, we are going to speak with Reuben Johnson about Ukraine, Americans' perspective on the ground there, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Reuben Johnson. We hosted him on our Securing America TV program last month and thought it's an opportune moment to have him join us once again with an update on what is happening in the country in which he resides, Ukraine, and whether, as is being widely forecast, tomorrow may be D-Day for Russian forces set to invade Ukraine. He is a Ukraine-based defense technology analyst and political affairs correspondent. He has written, among other places, in Breaking Defense and the Washington Free Beacon. And we're always delighted to have a chance to pick his brains. Reuben, thank you so much for joining us and welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Frank. Very kind of you to give some time to this important story.
That's a hugely important story, and we're going to talk a bit about why in a moment. But before we do, I thought maybe we could just sort of level set on what, from your perspective, is happening at the moment and what the prospects are that tomorrow may bring a Russian invasion, another Russian invasion of Ukraine, or if not tomorrow, perhaps in the not-too-distant future.
Well, there's been quite a bit of – there's been official warnings coming from Washington, from London, and from elsewhere, that there would be the Russian invasion would kick off tomorrow. This has sparked a lot of activity, embassies being evacuated. The U.S. embassy in Kiev is actually officially closed at this point. And the Ukrainians have sort of come back and said, okay, well, tomorrow's the invasion. The Ukrainian president called it tomorrow will be a national holiday, a day of national unity, so that everyone is prepared to fight and resist. So we don't know if the invasion is kicking off or not tomorrow. The things that have happened that we know is that the Russians declared that they had finished their quote-unquote exercises with all these troops, probably the largest exercises in the history of post-Soviet Russia, and that they were going to pull some of them back from the border. But as of the last hour or so, I believe I'm correct in that NATO is saying there's still no evidence of any withdrawal. Secondly, there was a meeting and then a joint press conference earlier today between Russian President Vladimir Putin and the new German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. And Putin never misses a chance to distort historical facts in a way which are just quite incredible. But Putin went on, as he goes on quite often in this press conference, about how Ukraine should never be allowed to join NATO. And, you know, this should never happen. This would be the worst thing in the world, et cetera. And the German chancellor said, well, you know, Ukraine's never applied for NATO membership. You know, we're a long way from talking about anything like that. And there was almost a comical moment when he said, if Ukraine ever did join NATO, I'm pretty sure it would be after both of us have left office. And then he sort of looked at Putin, because we all assume Putin's going to be president for life. So they went back and forth, and Putin at one point accused NATO of being an aggressive power because it conducted airstrikes on Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia in the 90s. And the German chancellor said, well, this was to prevent genocide because of what was going on in the former Yugoslavia between the Serbs and Muslims that were being massacred in different parts of the former Yugoslavia. And Putin shot back and said, yes, but there's been genocide in the Donbass. It's funny because no one's ever reported anything like that. And then the last thing, which has just happened in the last couple of hours or so, is that two of the largest Ukrainian banks and the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense and the Armed Forces and some other major entities have all been hit by cyber attacks and have had their websites brought down. Now, these are not attacks in the case of the MOD. Reportedly, these are not attacks that would affect the chain of command, but they are denial of service attacks. And it's the second time the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense and the Armed Forces websites and the websites of the two largest Ukrainian banks and some other Ukrainian agencies and institutions were hit with cyber attacks. And this is now the second time that there's been a wave of cyber attacks by the Russians on these Ukrainian state websites. The MOD, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and some others were hit a few weeks ago. And there were all sorts of threatening messages pasted all over the web pages about the worst is coming, you should be afraid. So it's all consistent.
And there's no question that they were Russian-sourced attacks?
Well, you know, the lawyers will say you can't say that. If we want to use evidence that would stand up in court, I don't think we'd ever accuse anybody of anything. It's like the North Korean cyber attacks. And then when you trace, then they're always traced back to servers in China, but they're servers in China that they're hijacking. So it defies any sort of common sense to believe that it's anyone other than the Russians, given everything that's happening at the moment.
So when you look at the attacks so far, if they're denial of service on websites, that's perhaps a nuisance rather than something that degrades the Ukrainian defense capabilities. Is that your current assessment of it, and that worse could in fact be in the offing, but hasn't demonstrated yet the full capacity of the Russians to engage in cyber warfare?
No, it's not their full capacity, and these could be trial runs. And then the other thing you have to remember is that the Russians and the Chinese, both the Russians invented the science in some ways, but they both practice in their information warfare operations. They practice a concept which we call reflexive control, and it's all about taking certain actions that will cause your adversary to unknowingly make wrong decisions. And by taking certain actions and watching how the other side reacts, you develop over a period of time a set of stimulus that you can use that you know will cause your adversary to make these wrong decisions. So you never know what part of the game they're playing. Are they doing setup or something later? Is this psychological warfare? Is it harassment? What is it?
So that's a good overview of the situation. I guess it's fair to say that it's not clear whether the warnings of an imminent attack are correct, or whether it may be, as I tend to think, something that is a distinct possibility, but probably wouldn't be triggered until after the genocide games are over in Beijing. Do you have a thought about that, and are you making a book on it?
Well, my thought about the attacks is simply this. Of course, there's no guarantee until these units are withdrawn from the border, and the units which have been deployed from very, very far distant base staging areas, like the units that have been brought all the way from the Russian Far East until they return to base. I saw General Breedlove interviewed the other night, and he made a very good point. He said, if you checked...
Is he European command?
Yeah, General Philip Breedlove, who was the former NATO commander, the former SACEUR, who I've had the chance to spend some time with in some war games in which we gained out a Russian attack on Poland in the Baltics. But he made the point that if you looked a couple of weeks ago or so, all these Russian vehicles were parked in, basically out in very big staging areas, purposely set so that satellites would see them. And that's part of the psychological game. You let your opponent take satellite photos so you can see how many units there are ready to move. But now they've been deployed up close to the border, poised to roll across the border, ready for attack. So that's worrying. Until they're moved away from those, ready to launch positions, we're not in a safe spot.
Well, and safe is probably not what you are in, even if they're at further remove, given the nature of this regime in the Kremlin. Which brings me to the larger point that I wanted to get into with you, Ruben. A man who I generally find does a remarkable job of addressing the public policy issues of our day, Tucker Carlson, of Fox News fame, has thrown himself in, I think it's fair to say, with those who believe that Ukraine is none of our business, that it has no strategic importance, that we have no responsibility, certainly, for its security in the face of the threats that the Russians are mounting. And that, if anything, it's more or less the same as Russia, an authoritarian regime that really isn't deserving of the title of a democracy. He said words to this effect now quite frequently over the past couple of weeks, and seems to be kind of the general mindset that what the Biden administration is saying and doing about this is sort of in the wag the dog sort of mode of an effort to distract attention from what is clearly going wrong for this administration here in the United States. How, as an American living in Kyiv and deeply knowledgeable about national security issues and our strategic equities, do you respond?
I'm so glad you asked me this. I like Tucker Carlson a lot. I'm a big Fox fan, but on this issue, he probably deserves the Joe Biden Award for being completely wrong on a foreign policy issue. As Bob Gates has always described Biden's inability to get the decision right. Okay, first of all, one of the big arguments we hear about Ukraine and the reason why we shouldn't be spending any time on it is that, oh, China is the big threat to America. We're worried about China. Let's take care of China. Okay, I'll buy that. However, everyone seems to forget that 3 years ago, the Chinese were trying every single trick in the book that they could to purchase a very large aerospace jet engine design and production facility in Zaporozhye, Ukraine, company called Motorsich. And there was a steady parade of people coming into Kyiv from Washington, including at the time John Bolton, who was the national security advisor, imploring everyone from the Ukrainian president on down, don't sell this company to China. Why not? Well, because the Chinese are jumping every day by leaps and bounds, from one level to another in the sophistication of their defense sector. They're building stealthy fighter aircraft, which they couldn't do before. They're building all kinds of things they couldn't do before. But the one thing they can't do are jet engines. They've had to buy jet engines from Russia. That's slowing them down. If they get this Ukrainian company, that will plug one of the remaining gaps in their defense industrial base. We don't want that to happen. It's so important. I mean, we were told over and over how important that was. Suddenly, with the threat of Russia invading Ukraine, who would gladly hand this company over to the Chinese, suddenly it's not important anymore. I find that quite fascinating. But the problems don't end there. The Russians conveniently forget about and never mention the fact that in 1994, Ukraine turned over what was at the time the world's third largest arsenal of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons left on the ground in Ukraine after the breakup of the Soviet Union. They were returned to Russia. And in along with the Kazakhs, Kazakhstan and Belarus, they all three countries did the same. And it, and what was signed in 1994, the year that this happened, was the Budapest Memorandum, in which Russia stated, full stop, that in return for receiving their nuclear weapons back that they were taking over from the days of the Soviet Union, in return for that, they would recognize the borders of Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan in perpetuity, period. No interpretation, no nuances, no nothing. In perpetuity. And the United States and Great Britain, France, and China also signed on and said that they would guarantee the security of these three nations who were giving up their nuclear weapons. Well, we now see that Belarus has been occupied, and we see that Kazakhstan still has a lot of heavy Russian control internally, and now the Russians just want to take over and invade all of Ukraine. If Ukraine is invaded and taken by the Russians without anyone firing a shot, you can't forget about nuclear proliferation for the rest of mankind's history. The North Koreans will never give up their nuclear weapons if this is allowed to happen. The Iranians will never stop trying to build a nuclear bomb. The Pakistanis and the Indians will never stop building more bombs so they can destroy each other. And countries that don't have nuclear weapons now, who see how terrible the United States is at holding up its security guarantees, I'm talking about Japan, I'm talking about South Korea, I'm talking about Australia, possibly Taiwan, possibly Poland, all of these countries will try to acquire their own nuclear arsenals. So from the nuclear non-proliferation position alone, allowing Russia to roll over Ukraine will be a disaster we'll have to live with for forever.
I agree. And I think it's both very important to make this point, and you've made it very powerfully. To the extent that we have this taking place, in particular against the backdrop of what Tucker Carlson and I, and I'm sure you agree, was an unmitigated disaster in Afghanistan. The need to honor our commitments made by a Democratic president, no less, back in 1994, is just, it seems to me, even greater importance than it would have been just a few months ago. And to the extent that Ukraine does wind up succumbing to the Russians, I fear that, especially having done so little to prevent it, we will be permanently regarded as an absolutely unreliable ally. And the argument for making a separate peace, not just with the Russians, but with the Chinese and others, something that I'm sure is weighing on lots of countries around the world now, will become that much more compelling, I would think. Your thoughts, Reuben Johnson?
Henry Kissinger used to say that, and he was, I think, only half joking, but he used to say that it was more dangerous to be America's friend than America's enemy. And this could put that, just allowing Ukraine to go under without taking any real action of any kind in a kinetic sense, that could cement that concept for good. Yes.
That's the concern.
And I'll just say this. I've got people, this is not just me, I have people from all over Eastern Europe, you know, Poland, other places, some people who were quite happy when they saw Joe Biden elected because they bought into this whole concept that Trump was, you know, such a horrible, horrible orange man or whatever. But even these people are now screaming and saying what was going on in Joe Biden's head when at the very beginning of this crisis, he said, oh, there's no way we'd send American combat troops. He just took them off the table.
Which is repeated.
So there is this thing, it's called strategic ambiguity. That's what we do with Taiwan. That was absolutely boneheaded. And the second boneheaded statement was this idiotic outburst that he made in one of his press conferences about, oh, well, if it's only a minor incursion, that's okay. Those two statements could easily lead to the deaths of tens of thousands of people, and I am not exaggerating.
Boneheaded is one way of explaining it. Another is quite possibly, as we certainly believe is the case with China, that the money that was provided his son by a widow, or excuse me, the wife of the mayor of Moscow, millions of dollars may have been an influential factor as well, to say nothing of the Burisma and other, you know, complications that the Biden team has. But let me just ask you very quickly, Ruben, in just a minute, if you would, speak to the proposition advanced by Tucker Carlson, among others, that Ukraine is actually not a democracy. It is an authoritarian system, again, unworthy of the description of a democracy, let alone the benefits of being treated as one by us.
Okay, there's a very simple answer to this, and I have to make this statement all the time. If we are going to use these standards that we're now applying to Ukraine, if we're going to apply them across the board, there's only three countries in the world that we're going to deal with and say that are deserving of our support. And those three countries are the U.S., Canada, and the U.K., United Kingdom, Canada, and sometimes Germany. Because, okay, fine, if we want to apply those standards, we're going to apply them to everybody. So you're going to tell me that Pakistan's not corrupt. You're going to tell me Indonesia's not corrupt. You're going to tell me all these countries in Central America we've been pouring money into for more than 40 years to fight the drug cartel. They're not corrupt. Nobody's corrupt but Ukraine. Everybody else is just as clean as beyond the corruption.
Ruben, it's also this idea that, as Tucker put it, I think just last night, there are situations like the opposition leader is in prison, and that the, you know, media is under very strict constraints and the like. Could you just quickly speak to the truth as you see it on those counts?
The media are not under strict constraints, and the opposition leader. The reason the opposition leader has been treated as he has been, the reason his television stations had their licenses pulled, is because he was openly going to Moscow. He was openly sitting down with Putin, and he was openly trying to undermine everything that the Ukrainian president was trying to do. And one of his trips to Moscow, he sat down with Putin and he said, oh, well, you know, you people in Ukraine, you really don't want to be with the EU. Here's an Eastern alternative. We can unify with Russia, which nobody wants. Nobody wants that. Ukraine will become another vassal state if that happens.
We have to leave it at that, Ruben Johnson. You and the country that you inhabit and that I know you love are in our prayers, and I hope that you will all be spared what I believe Vladimir Putin does have in mind, whether it's this week or next week or at some point in the future, which is returning Ukraine to the kind of enslavement that it experienced for so long under the years of the Soviets and others.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.